I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, here's a question. How much English is enough English to serve in public office? A small border town in Arizona is debating that question after a city council candidate was ordered removed from the ballot because she was deemed to lack sufficient proficiency in English. This in a town where most residents actually speak Spanish. We will look at this very interesting question in a few minutes. But first, we want to take a look at the national political landscape as we inch closer to the 2012 general election. Yesterday, Florida primary voters were the latest to head to the polls, and they handed former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney a big win. But both former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Texas Congressman Ron Paul are both vowing to stay in the race until the Republican convention in August. So just what do the latest results mean in the race for the GOP nomination? Here to answer that question and more are two of our regular political analysts. Corey Elans is a former White House communications advisor for President Barack Obama. He's now the senior vice president of the communications firm Vox Global. That's here in Washington, D.C. Mario Loyola is a contributor to National Review. That is the noted conservative publication. He's also the director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a conservative think tank. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Always good to be here.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with last night's results in Florida. What else? Mitt Romney won decisively, but he used his victory speech to reframe an issue that's being talked about a lot in political circles. Let's just play a short clip.
They like to comfort themselves with the thought that a competitive campaign will leave us divided and weak. But I've got news for them. A competitive primary does not divide us, it prepares us, and we will win.
Well, the they, of course, is the Democrats more broadly, and I would assume the Obama administration folks or Obama political team more specifically. But Corey Elans, what about that? Because people might remember in 2008, taking a trip down memory lane there, the primary contest between President Obama, then Senator Obama, and then Senator Hillary Clinton was competitive. It was aggressive. It was lasted a long time. It was tiring, especially for the people who were on the road like you were. What about that analogy? Could it? But people make the argument that it did, in fact, you know, as iron sharpens iron, it kind of aired out whatever potential issues may have existed against the ultimate nominee so that by the time the general election rolled around, they had all been dealt with. What about that argument?
Well, there are two things that Romney was trying to do last night with that particular point. First, he was trying to say, look, we're going to be fine. I know I spent a ridiculous amount of money here in Florida bashing Newt Gingrich, but the party ultimately is going to be able to come together. The second piece, he was saying, look, just like Obama and Clinton back in 2008, they went through a rough primary session, but ultimately they came together, the party came together, and they were successful. It's an apples and oranges comparison. The reason is because if you look at the sincere and genuine enthusiasm that you had for each of those candidates, Obama and Clinton, in 2008, them going against each other in the rough and tumble way that they did actually made them stronger individually, and whomever had emerged was going to be a very strong candidate. Also, too, you were running against the best and brightest that we had in the Democratic Party at this time. It's been said over and over again that this is one of the weakest Republican fields that we've seen in some time. So if Romney emerges as the victor, he will have done so against one of the weakest fields in history and having spent an extraordinarily crazy amount of money and run an intensely negative campaign.
Okay, but what about my specific question, which is that one advantage could be that this airs out the potential attack lines that the president's campaign team could level against Romney. And by the time November rolls around, people will have heard it all. They say, okay, fine. You know, yes, he made a ridiculous amount of money. Yes, he has, you know, an offshore bank account, you know, yada, yada, yada.
I think it
goes, been there, done that.
I think it goes back to the point about enthusiasm for the candidates. Ultimately, Mitt Romney is still in the place after having spent millions of dollars over the course of the past year. We don't know more about him than we knew a year ago. And that's why you see that consistent, persistent enthusiasm gap there for him right now. It's saved. You didn't see that in 2008 with the Democrats, but you see that now with Republicans. And that's the charge. That's the challenge he has.
Mario, obviously, I want to hear your take on this. And I'm also interested in your take on whether, you know, Newt Gingrich says he's going to stay. Let's focus on Newt Gingrich for a minute, because Ron Paul hasn't managed to win any primary, even though he's been, you know, still managed to be an interesting candidate and raise interesting issues. I'm interested in whether they, in fact, do have a path to the convention. So your take, please.
Well, we've got a lot of the primaries that are ahead of us now are not winner-take-all primaries, so he can continue, Gingrich can continue to rack up delegates all the way to the convention. And look, I mean, 2008 it was a contest of personalities. The more worrisome comparison for conservatives is 1976, when Ronald Reagan challenged Gerald Ford all the way to the floor of the convention, and Ford ultimately got the nomination but emerged from the convention 30 points down under Carter. Luckily, he was running against Jimmy Carter, who eliminated a lot of that lead. But the thing to consider is, you know, in 1976, you had a fight for the soul of the Republican Party. Ronald Reagan was representing, you know, a new strengthened conservative movement against the old Northeast, Midwest, progressive Republican establishment. That's exactly the conflict that we have now in many people's eyes. And, you know, Gerald Ford was from Michigan, obviously Mitt Romney, Massachusetts. His father was governor of Michigan, whereas Gingrich represents, you know, that it's trying to represent and trying to speak to that part of the conservative movement that is angry. You know, that wants to defeat President Obama really, really badly.
But I guess the same question, Mario, to you, that to Corey, is, does this bitter battle, and I don't think you can describe it as anything but bitter at this stage, does it ultimately help the nominee or hurt him? The Republican nominee.
I mean, in 1976, it certainly hurt the Republican nominee. We probably lost that election chiefly because of the pardon, because Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon, and because Ronald Reagan challenged him all the way to the convention.
Okay.
Now, you know, there are lots of angles of attack that the president can't use, that we've seen in these primaries, that the president can't use. I mean, you know, one of Gingrich's main lines of attack against Romney has been to compare him to Obama. Obviously, Obama's not going to attack Romney if he's the candidate by comparing him to himself.
Give him a big hug and a smoochie at every turn, yeah. Saying, love you. Love you, man.
Michelle, you're so much like me. We're so alike.
We're so alike. Hold on a second. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're visiting with Mario Loyola, a contributor to the National Review. That's the noted conservative publication. And Corey Elans, a former communications advisor to President Barack Obama. We're talking about last night's results and whatever else is on their minds. Corey?
Corey, one other quick point is this piece is much more personal with the Republicans right now, with Romney and Gingrich going after each other. This is very, very personal right now, and that's why you see the reaction that you're getting from Newt Gingrich. He's going to stay in this race just so he can throw Mitt Romney under the bus. And I think he'll do anything that he can at this point to keep him from getting the nomination.
I don't know. Obama-Hillary thing seemed a little personal to me. I mean, they seem to have gotten over it, but wasn't that essentially a character battle? Wasn't it essentially an argument over who had the character to lead the country at that pivotal historical
moment? I don't know if
it
was character.
The differences philosophically were just not that large.
Well, exactly. And I think that was much more about experience, the fact that Hillary had been there and then Senator Obama had not. And so that was the rub at that point.
Well, Mario, this is our first real peek as to how Latino voters are responding to the GOP candidates. Can you just tell us what you saw?
Well, Latinos broke for Romney in a big way. There's a couple of things there. The three Cuban-American representatives from South Florida endorsed Romney a couple of months ago. Of course, Senator Marco Rubio hasn't endorsed anyone formally, but you've had the political establishment of the Cuban-American community has really embraced and, you know, coordinated carefully with Governor Romney. You know, and Latinos there's going to be a lot of commentary about that, you know, comparing positions on immigration and so forth. You know, on immigration, both Speaker Gingrich and Governor Romney are fairly open-minded and progressive and are not really stridently anti-immigrant. It's not fair to describe either of them as anti-immigrant. But look, I think there's something more visceral here, which is that Latinos... I have the sense that Latinos, maybe more than other groups of voters, tend to vote for the person that they like more. And Romney is a nice guy, you know, and the people who like Gingrich like him because he's not a nice guy, you know. And the people who like Gingrich and gravitate towards Gingrich like him because he's angry like they are. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. And it's something to watch. It'll be something to watch. But then again, wouldn't this argue advantage Obama? Because his likability, even when people don't approve of his performance, they still like him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Republican candidate's way to overcome that is going to be to say, look, yeah, Obama's a nice guy. He just doesn't know what he's doing. And frankly, I mean, compared to Clinton, that case is going to be a fairly easy one to make, I think.
Well,
in the general election.
Something to watch. One more thing, Corey, before we let you go. We must talk about the super PACs and also the fundraising figures. A Federal Election Commission filing show that in the last quarter of 2011, President Obama's campaign raised $40 million. That brings his bank balance to a cool $81 million. He's getting a lot of money from donors who are giving $200 or less, whereas Mr. Romney's and Gingrich's campaigns are getting big donations from people who are maxed out. But then there is the super PACs. Do you think the Obama a team is worried that the super PACs will erase their fundraising advantage?
Oh, that's always a threat. Another quick point to make is that the majority of the donations for the Obama campaign have come from people who are in the middle class, while the majority of the contributions for the Romney effort are coming from folks who are much more like him, from big donors. And so, yes, I think that one of the things that President Obama is going to have to wrap his head around very quickly is how he's going to deal with the super PACs, because right now he's not really letting people give to the super PACs. He's not encouraging them to do so, not that he can. But this is something that he's going to have to wrap his head around, because he's going to be at a severe disadvantage potentially come the fall when you just have one candidate and everybody's got their guns bearing
on
him.
But if he does, then doesn't it lead into that Tweedledee, Tweedledum argument that progressives make, is that there's really no big difference between the two political parties. So what's the difference?
Well, I will tell you that ultimately this is about making sure that you're in a position of power to continue to do the things that you think are best for the country. So campaigns are about winning at the end.
Well, both of you have given us something to think about and to watch, so we'll keep watching. Corey Elans is a former White House communications advisor for President Barack Obama. He's now senior vice president of the communications firm Vox Global here in Washington, D.C. He was with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Mario Loyola is a contributor to National Review and director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He was with us from Austin, Texas. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Always good. Be well.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As you just heard, we've been focused on the battle to determine which Republican will have the right to contest President Obama come this fall. But there's another argument brewing over who will get to vote. Many states are now requiring a government-issued ID to vote. The people who have instituted these measures say it's just common sense in a time when you have to have one to drive or get on a plane or enter a government building. So we wondered, who doesn't have one and why don't they? NPR's Corey Dade has been looking into this, and he will tell us what he found out in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to another thorny election issue, this time in a local race. In the border town of San Luis, Arizona, a judge struck a potential city council candidate from the ballot because her English skills were deemed inadequate. That's because state law requires government office holders to be able to speak, write, and read in English. Alejandrina Cabrera is appealing the decision, saying that most of the predominantly Mexican-American population of the town would be comfortable with her English.
It's not perfect, but it's perfect for this position in San Luis, Arizona, because the people speak both language, but the people prefer Spanish.
That was Ms. Cabrera speaking at a press conference earlier this week. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon the mayor of San Luis, Juan Carlos Escamilla, and Michelle Faust. She's been reporting on this story for member station KAWC in Yuma, Arizona. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Hello.
Thank you.
And before we begin, I want to point out that we tried to reach Alejandrina Cabrera, but her lawyer said that she is ill and she was unable to provide a statement or be with us. So with that being said, Michelle Faust, how long has this law been in effect and what does it say?
Well, let me just give a little bit of background. When they created the state constitution, which was just a few years before, we're coming up on our centennial, so a couple of years before they adopted it in 1912, they said to serve in any office in the state, and I'm going to read it, Statute 38201, a person who is unable to speak, write, and read the English language is not eligible to hold a state, county, city, town, or precinct office in the state, whether elective or appointive.
So this is, as you just pointed out, this is very helpful. This is a very long-standing standard for holding office in the state.
Exactly.
And is there a specific benchmark that the court is expected to use, a specific standard to determine proficiency in English?
This is exactly the question at hand. The lawyers are arguing that the linguistic expert that came in and the judge determined what level of proficiency should count to be able to hold office in the city of San Luis. her lawyers are arguing that while her English is deficient, she does not even argue that that's not the case, but she speaks enough for the city of San Luis.
Okay, let's turn to Mayor Escamilla now. I understand, do I have this right, that you filed the legal challenge to Ms. Cabrera's English abilities? What were your main concerns?
Well, even though Mrs. Cabrera is able to speak a few words in English, she cannot understand it. If you were to give her a few sentences, she would be able to read it, but she wouldn't be able to tell you back what she just read. And it's so critical and so important nowadays, especially all our daily business at the city is all done in English. How would you make the right choice for our people if you're not able to understand the materials that's being presented before you?
We're talking about a case in Arizona that has raised questions about whether good English language skills should be required to serve in public office and just what constitutes adequate English proficiency. We're speaking with the mayor of San Luis, Arizona, Juan Carlos Escamilla. He raised the challenge to the city council candidate who has been barred from the ballot. And we're also speaking with KAWC reporter Michelle Faust, who's been covering this controversy. Michelle Faust, how has this challenge been received by the community? If you just give us the points of view that you're getting.
First of all, let me just say that when I approach people in San Luis, I usually interview them in Spanish. I try to start conversations in English, but they usually end up in Spanish. So it's quite obvious that Spanish is usually the preferred language on the streets in the city of San Luis. However, that said, there are many people that I spoke to who said it shouldn't matter her linguistic ability. And I did speak to a couple of people who said in Spanish to me, you know, she should be ethical and speak the language of the country where she is working. And so everyone has their own opinion, but it is really important that someone who doesn't live in the area understand how language works in our community.
Mr. Mayor, you've said yourself, you've been quoted as saying your own English is far from perfect. Do you find that Michelle's analysis is correct in that when you speak to your constituents of the town in general, do you find that you are generally speaking to them in Spanish also?
That is correct. We are a large Hispanic population, but just because we're Hispanic doesn't mean that we're not able to understand the language. I mean, there's a large population that speak both Spanish and English. There's a very small percentage that only speaks Spanish. And I mean, if you were to go down to our down street area, mostly will be spoken in Spanish. And the reason for that is we are a border community. We do get 65,000 people coming across every single day that only speak Spanish. So we cater to that industry. But just because we're a large population of Hispanic doesn't mean that we cannot speak English.
Mr. Mayor, before we let you go, what do you think this controversy is about? You know, on the one hand, you could say the rules are the rules. And other people might say this is an example of the kind of ongoing anxiety that people have in this country about the growing Latino diaspora and so forth. What do you think it's about?
Well, I mean, I've always believed nobody is above the law. And I strongly believe that the citizens of San Luis deserve a representative to be able to speak to them. Our government just not in our city limits. I mean, we are a border town. We are the first line of defense. And a lot of times, a lot of the issues that we face cannot be fixed within our city limits. We need to be able to advocate those concerns at a higher level. And all that is conducted in English. And it's so critical and so essential to be able to do your job and represent the people of San Luis. So it's fundamental in order to be able to really do your job.
Juan Carlos Escamilla is the mayor of San Luis, Arizona, and he joined us from his office there. Michelle Faust is a reporter and the host of Morning Edition from member station KAWC. She joined us from her office in Yuma, Arizona. Thank you both.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'd like to focus on another political battle that could influence the general elections in November, voter ID laws. 31 states have either introduced or tightened voter requirements in recent months. 15 of those states have made it mandatory to show government-issued photo ID before casting a ballot. So what's the big deal, you say? Well, these days we need photo IDs to do just about everything from cashing a check to buying cough medicine to entering a government building. But it's not that simple. Supporters, mostly conservative Republicans, say voter ID laws prevent election fraud. But opponents, mainly Democrats and progressive groups, say the laws are really designed to suppress voter turnout, especially among certain groups. And it turns out that more than 3 million Americans actually don't own a government-issued picture ID. That's according to a recent study by New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. We wanted to know more about this. Why don't people have voter IDs or have government-issued IDs, and who are they? So we've called upon NPR digital correspondent Corey Dade, who's been looking into this. Corey, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
So let me just summarize the politics of this right now, just so that we can kind of get to some of the stories that you found out. We've been reporting on this. So 31 states in all require voters to show some form of ID in order to vote. But since Mr. Obama was elected, more than 8 states have enacted voter ID laws. And this is where the opponents of the law are crying foul. They say that the passage of these laws just happens to be in key battleground states that Obama won in 2008, like Florida, Indiana, and Ohio, Colorado, and Virginia. So that being said, we're interested in who doesn't have a voter ID these days, or who doesn't have a government-issued ID. What did you find out?
That's a good question, Michelle. I think the first thing to look at is to look at who actually drives. The most common form of government-issued ID are driver's licenses. And so the people who are most unlikely to drive, as it is elderly, the poor, people who live in big cities like African Americans, especially young people too, especially if they attend college, they may not have need for a car at the moment. And then people who are in rural areas, the other challenge for them is they are not near the Department of Motor Vehicles offices, et cetera, where you would get these IDs.
And you met a voter like that. Would you tell us about her?
I did. I talked with Ruthel Frank. She's 84 years old. She lives in Brokaw, Wisconsin. And she has an interesting story because she typifies what many seniors are experiencing. Many of them never had birth certificates to begin with. And if they did, they were incorrectly, their names were incorrectly put onto these documents. And if that's the case, then you're not going to get an ID. They will not accept discrepancies between your birth certificate and other forms of ID that you may have, like a Social Security card and those kinds of things.
And so you, what did she tell you?
Well, let's listen to what she had to say when I interviewed her.
I laid my baptismal certificate on top of the counter because I figured that all the information that they would need would be on that baptismal certificate. And she looked at me and she said, well, this is illegal. She said, how do I know that you aren't an alien? I was, well, just like somebody took a pan and hit me in the face. I could have cried.
So here's an example of a person who had been voting for years.
Right.
Fits all these issues that you talked about. She's elderly. She's doesn't drive.
Right.
She was born at a time when there was not a lot of attention paid to these sort of details, particularly for African Americans. Others would argue that the issue of voter fraud is significant enough that people ought to
just go and get the ID.
They just go and get the ID. So the question is, why don't they?
If you are an eligible voter, why not just go get the ID? And I think with Ruthel Frank, it's important to note that she's the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit filed in Wisconsin by the American Civil Liberties Union. That organization is actually trying to overturn this law. So beyond that, though, for starters, again, if you're someone trying to get a voter ID, you need that type of documentation. In order to get an ID, you often need an ID. So it becomes a catch-22.
And what about are the states making any provision to help voters like this who have not previously had IDs to get them? Or are interest groups doing that?
Well, they are. The interest groups are trying to fill in the void of information. Where to get the IDs, what kind of documents you need to get them when you show up so you're not caught unawares. As far as the states go, they are issuing non-driver voter IDs. Many of them are for free, but the problem is when you go to Department of Motor Vehicle offices, the waits are very long, they're time-consuming. The governor of Tennessee, who's a Republican, by the way, he has expressed concern about the average wait times there, which extend well beyond an hour. And if you're talking about thousands of elderly in particular, they can't wait that long.
Well, it turns out that it seems as though this is going to be a story that's going to actually continue, that's going to be with us for a while, because it really does seem to have an impact, particularly in certain states.
Absolutely. You have legal cases that are coming up from state to state. South Carolina got its proposed law rejected by the Department of Justice, and they are mounting a $1 million case to take it to federal court. And that's going to happen from state to state.
That's NPR's digital correspondent Corey Dade speaking to us about voter ID laws and what groups of Americans are most likely not to have IDs. He's been reporting on this, and he joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Once again, thanks so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
And now we want to take a moment to remember the life and legacy of Don Cornelius, the creator of Soul Train. He was found dead today in his California home of a gunshot wound. He was 75 years old. Don Cornelius will be remembered as the silky-voiced host who brought African-American dance and music to a wider audience. The syndicated program helped launch the careers or showcase the talents of countless household names, including Stevie Wonder, Chaka Khan, and James Brown. Here to tell us more about this is NPR. Our correspondent Karen Grigsby Bates, who profiled the 40-year history of Soul Train back in 2010. Karen, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Michelle.
You know, a lot of us learned our moves from watching Soul Train back in the day. I don't need to date myself by counting myself as one of those. But was the show important for the American culture overall, beyond African American?
You know, it was, because this was on nationally, and basically what it did was show black kids sort of just being themselves without really thinking about having to be a model minority or anything else, having fun. And it made other people want to have fun, too. The difference between Soul Train, I think, and a couple of the other dance shows that existed at that point was that while Don Cornelius was targeting this at black audiences and black kids, he welcomed everybody aboard. He said, you know, we're doing it. We think it's the bomb. If you think it's the bomb, come on over here.
Like Casey and the Sunshine Band, for example, fronted by a performer who is not African American.
Sure. The average white band showed up and people jammed to him. And this guy named Gino Vannelli, who says, I never would have had a career if Don Cornelius hadn't said, I don't care if he's a white boy. He is a soulful white boy. He is coming on the show.
And that's in front of the camera. Behind the scenes, I think important to note that Don Cornelius owned the show at a time when very few people of color, black people, owned media entities. I just want to play a short clip from a documentary that was done, or maybe this is an interview, that where he talked about why this was important to him.
After a short time on radio, the first thing I began to really notice is that there was no black television. That television was just white this, white that, general market this, white that. No TV that targeted our culture.
He told me that when I interviewed him on the celebration of the 40th anniversary, a documentary that was done, and he felt very strongly because people said, nobody's going to buy this. There's not going to be any advertisers. So he lined up the advertisers, and after the first couple of shows, people were like, wow, they buy things.
What's his legacy, Karen?
I think a couple of things. Right now, the popularity of scores of dance shows and even talent shows like The X Factor and American Idol sort of have their genesis in Soul Train. I think it was a natural precursor to the music videos that we see now, where lots of dancing, lots of moves go on.
Even little kids shows.
Even
kids
little
kids younger shows. Kids yeah. that feature dance.
The other thing is that it was a great font of inspiration for style, and lots of designers now, couturiers even, talk about the fact that style often doesn't come from the couture house down. It filters from the street up. And for better or for worse, thank you, Mr. Cornelius, for those hot pants.
No comment. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios remembering the legendary Don Cornelius, host of Soul Train. He was found dead in his home today, and he was 75. Thank you, Karen.
My pleasure.
Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's Black History Month, and this year we decided to acknowledge it by talking about a type of literature that has expanded our understanding of the experience of African Americans. We're talking about the memoir. Just about every day, it seems, a new memoir shows up on the bookstore shelf or in your e-reader, penned by the famous and not so famous. It's a phenomenon as far as African Americans, anyway, that dates as far back as the journals set down by former slaves. Now, though, there seems to be a new zeal to log family history or tell a compelling personal story. Every week this month, we will be digging into a new memoir or two. But to get us started, we wanted to talk more about what a memoir is and what they're all about. We have called upon three distinguished writers and scholars of English and African-American studies. They are Professor Dana Williams. She is chair of the Department of English and professor of African-American literature at Howard University. Lorene Carey is senior lecturer in the Department of English at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also author of a memoir, Black Ice. And Professor Elizabeth Alexander, she is chair of the African-American Studies Department at Yale University. She is also a poet who composed and read the poem Praise Song for the Day at President Barack Obama's inauguration. I welcome all of you. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you for inviting us.
Mm-hmm. Professor Williams, I'm going to start with you. It may be a silly question, but what is there a difference between memoir and autobiography? I think people are used to thinking of them interchangeably. Is there a difference?
I think it's actually a very good question. There is a slight distinction. And typically, the autobiography is seen as the kind of lead or overarching genre, and then the memoir is a subgenre of the autobiography. I would say that the smallest distinction is probably that the memoir tends to focus on a small aspect of a person's life or the public figure or the public aspect of an institution or an organization. So it's still a life story, but it's probably a more abbreviated version.
Like a slice.
Yes.
A bit of a slice. Professor Alexander, I think we talked about the slave journals. Can you just tell us a little bit about what we know about why these folks were motivated to start telling their stories at a time when it could almost be dangerous to do so?
Well, if you think, for example, about Frederick Douglass, he was an astonishing orator, and part of his abolitionist mission was to go around the country and the world telling the story of his journey to freedom. Eventually, what his audiences and his sponsors realized is that if the book were written, if it were published, if it could be distributed, then it would reach far more people and thus serve the abolitionist cause even better. Well, as it turns out, Douglass was also an astonishing writer, a brilliant writer, someone who couldn't just tell a story, but also could tell it compellingly and beautifully. And so his 1845 narrative stands now as a work of literature that probably all of us have taught, and also a book that literally helped to end slavery. No small thing.
Lorene Carey, one of the reasons we're so glad to talk with you is that you have penned one, and you wrote one at a pretty young age. It was about your experience as a student at a New England boarding school, the first group of girls to attend this school, and you and I share that experience, oddly enough. So I wanted to ask, what made you want to write one?
I wanted to out that experience. You're talking to me, by the way, just a few months after I've been appointed to the School Reform Commission here in Philadelphia. And for me, going from public school to a boarding school in New England was an experience of going from an education where basically many of my teachers as I was growing up looked at us and tried to figure out what was wrong with us in order to try to fix us and get us better, to an experience where all of these people looked at us as if to try very hard to figure out what was special and exquisite about us. I felt the difference in those expectations, and it made me furious that we weren't talking honestly about them, and I wanted to out the experience.
Do you think you wrote it mainly for yourself, in a way, to kind of put it down and understand it for yourself? I'm wondering who you had in mind as you were writing that work, which was a bestseller, by the way.
I'll tell you, Michelle, the first draft is always for myself. The first draft, I think, needs to be for oneself. The first draft is mapping the landscape, your own internal landscape, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, physically. It's therapy. It's getting honest. It's getting the tone. Typically, I have to write 200 pages until I write my way to the door of the book. So a lot of it is throwaway. It's getting good enough. It's running laps. And then after that, truth is, I didn't expect anybody to read the book, to be honest. I just hoped that it would get enough readers. They published 7,500, the first edition. I just hoped for enough readers so that I could get a contract for the next one.
But it did a lot better than that.
It did a lot better than
that. So what do you think people saw in it? Because it's still an experience that not a lot of people will have had.
I think that the first level is often sociological. People come to this to find out what it was like to be a scholarship girl at a boarding school that had been all boys, all white, all male, all wealthy. But then I think when, in order for people to stay with it, the book has to reflect something true about the experience of learning and of growing up. That's what people get from it. So I get all these letters from people who say, I was not a black girl in boarding school, comma, but. And then they tell all of their own experiences. It is the experience of learning or of figuring out how to give gifts that one didn't receive, or of how to overcome challenges, or of how to be in a situation where people do not expect the best of you, but figuring out how to exceed those expectations anyway.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're starting off Black History Month. This Black History Month, we decided to dig into memoirs that explore the African-American experience. But we wanted to start off with talking with three distinguished writers and scholars who have either penned a memoir or studied memoir to talk about what role memoir plays in the African-American experience. We're speaking with Laureen Carey, senior lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania. That's who was speaking just now. She's author of the memoir Black Ice. Also with us, Professor Elizabeth Alexander, chair of the African-American Studies Department at Yale University. She's also a poet. And you'll remember that she composed the poem Praise Song for the Day at President Barack Obama's inauguration, and Professor Dana Williams, chair of the Department of English at Howard University. Professor Williams, what's your take on why? I'm wondering if you share my perception that more people and a really wide array of people seem to be sharing their memoirs these days.
People, I think, are very interested not only in telling their stories for themselves, but having people see and understand the same thing, this coming into awareness and this coming into consciousness that they experience themselves. You can't pretend to know absolutely everything, but you can tell specifically the experience that you had and what you know and how it has impacted you, but also how it was shaped by the environment that you come out of and how it also shapes the environment as well.
Professor Alexander, have you seen, do memoirs seem to be like arguing a case or something, or trying to, what have you seen over the course of all the hundreds of years that the people have been writing these, particularly African Americans?
Well, I think in moving from the slave narratives, and I think we should put them at the beginning of thinking about African American autobiography and the kind of instrumentality of writing those books, you have other books moving forward that, because the person is someone of note, then in the literary world, that's a book that gets contracted. And what we have in the contemporary era, I think, is as black lives, more kinds of black lives have made their way into the mainstream imagination, I think, therefore, more people, and I'm thinking Condoleezza Rice. Do we talk about that as a literary memoir? Well, she came out with two books at about the same time. Mm-hmm. And the one that she wrote that was more about the Birmingham of her childhood, more about her coming of age, is a book that we read because she's someone whose name we know, and we think that we're going to get to go behind the veil, to use Du Bois's wonderful phrase. So I think more black lives are publicly known now, and so maybe that's why more black lives are making it into autobiographical form, even if these aren't the folks that we would necessarily think of as writers.
Well, you know, that brings me back to, I'll just call him memorist in chief, President Barack Obama. People think of Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance, as something he wrote as he was preparing to run for president, but that's actually not true. He was initially offered the contract to chronicle being elected the first black president of the Harvard Law Review. So he wrote that right after law school, he started. And we happen to have a narration of him reading the book, which he won a Grammy Award for Best Spoken Word. So let me just play a short clip from then. Here it is.
I know, I have seen, the desperation and disorder of the powerless, how it twists the lives of children on the streets of Jakarta or Nairobi in much the same way as it does the lives of children on Chicago's South Side, how narrow the path is for them between humiliation and untrammeled fury, how easily they slip into violence and despair. I know that the response of the powerful to this disorder, alternating as it does between a dull complacency and when the disorder spills out of its prescribed confines, a steady, unthinking application of force, of longer prison sentences, and more sophisticated military hardware, is inadequate to the task.
How does each of you hear this? Professor Alexander, I'll start with you. And as we mentioned, you did write the poem for President Obama's inauguration, so you do have a relationship, friendship, you know. But how do you read it? How do you hear it?
Well, I think it's a great memoir. It's a memoir that I've taught. It's a memoir that my colleague, the literary scholar Robert Steptoe, has written about. And what I think is so interesting about it is that it is an American coming-of-age story with literary ties to the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, to the Confessions of St. Augustine, to the autobiography of Malcolm X, even in a way to the sentimental women's novels of the 19th century, which end with, "Reader, I married him." And here we see that marriage is what ends or almost ends the book. So he's coming of age, but he's also in the book narrating a coming of and into a complex black identity. And that's what I particularly love about it, too, and what the recording of it lets us listen to when he goes in and out of all of the different voices of the characters who peopled his life growing up. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, finding himself also as he reads African-American literature, thinking about who the self is with a literary education to guide the formation of that self. I think it's a fascinating book.
Lorene, how about you? How do you read it or hear it?
I hear it as a story. By the way, this is one of the few times I get to say this, that he and I shared an agent for this book. And I remember my agent saying, "This is amazing. You are going to hear more from this person. This is an amazing memoir." And what she said was, "It's a joy to read," because, you know, she was thinking about selling a book. So I heard it first as a book that was needing to tell a story and needing to tell a story in a way that's beautiful. By the way, our conversation here is very serious, and you know, everybody's being called professor, and so we're being very, very intellectual and smart about this. But they should be fun to read. I mean, they should be.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They should be. Some of the times they're funny. They should be laugh out loud. They should be move you.
I'm sorry. I just want to tell you, we got something for you. Next week, we will be joined by Baratunde Thurston to talk about his memoir, How to Be Black. And just to give you a sense of the tone of it, he says, "If you don't buy this book, you're a racist." So I just want you to know that we heard you. We hear you. We will comply. Professor Williams, what do you... Lorene, had you finished your thought?
Sure.
Okay. Professor Williams, how do you read President Obama's... memoir? Or maybe you're ready to move on and tell us what your favorite memoir is, because that's how we're going to end up. We're asking each of you, what's your favorite memoir?
It's a really great book. I like it a lot. I think the thing that is most attractive to me is the effortlessness of the book. The prose flows so beautifully. So it's like we're saying, it's very easy to read. You're learning a lot at the same time, but you're also able to move through the narrative in a way that allows you to feel comfortable, and the language, the word choice, all beautiful.
And so what's your favorite? So this in the couple of minutes that we have left, and thank you all so much for taking the time to share with us about this. So Professor Williams, before we let you go, what's your favorite memoir? Do you have one?
Right now I'm reading Harry Belafonte's My Song, and it's becoming my favorite. It's a beautiful book. It's well written, but it's also a very true and poignant story.
Okay.
So I like the way especially that he talks about how he moves through the world with the effort to be precise and dignified. And I think the book takes on those two characteristics as well.
Okay. Lorene, Carrie, what about you? Do you have a favorite besides your own? Well, your own could be. You can pick your own. That's one of my favorites.
Well, I will tell you, it is, at the end of the day, when you write a book, really the only person who's been transformed is oneself. So it does impact you more. I love Frederick Douglass's narrative. I love it like I love my great-grandfather. It always stays with me.
Professor Alexander, final thought from you.
I love Audre Lorde's Zami, A New Spelling of My Name, a beautiful memoir which she calls a biomythography. And she talks about, I think it's wonderful the way that it says that telling the story of the self isn't always about empirical and verifiable truth. We know ourselves and understand our true selves in myth as much as we do in empirical fact. And she's a gorgeous poet and a gorgeous writer, and she plays around with the form, and it's a beautiful book.
Professor Elizabeth Alexander is chair of the African American Studies Department at Yale University. And as we mentioned, she's the poet who composed and read the poem Praise Song for the Day at the inauguration of President Barack Obama. And an illustrated children's version of that poem is being released next month with illustrations by David Diaz. And she was kind enough to join us from the studios at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Also with us, Lorene Carey. She is senior lecturer in the Department of English at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of many books, including her memoir, Black Ice. And Lorene Carey joined us from Philadelphia. And also with us, Professor Dana Williams. She is chair of the Department of English and professor of African American Literature at Howard University, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Ladies, professors, all, thank you all so much. Happy Black History Month to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Next week, as we mentioned, we will be joined by Baratunde Thurston to review his memoir, How to Be Black. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.